Planet Fitness has everything you need to get stronger just around the corner, so you can give everything you've got. Whether you want to crush a few reps before class with our expanded strength equipment or sweat it out on your way home from work, with over 2,800 locations, there's a Planet Fitness close to you, and most are open 24 hours. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends January 30th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
This episode was recorded for my UK column show. Please keep us independent by going to support.ukcolumn.org.
This is Germ Warfare, the battle of ideas.
Robin Vistrianic, thank you for joining me in the trenches.
Thanks for having me again.
You know, I get so bored of that intro, but I always get emails from people saying, yeah, I love it when you introduce people in the trenches like that.
Yeah, I'm in the trenches of Connecticut freezing my ass off. So, yeah, there's always been an information war about almost everything. So people try to control the narrative because of their own interests or whatever. So that's why we're where we are today, because people have all their own ideas and interests and they want to promote those and don't want to talk about the other things that don't look good. So like vaccines is just one example of that, disease and vaccines. So when you look at the actual data, it's a lot different than the stuff that they continuously promote and been promoting for like 300 years. It's been a long process.
Yeah, but I mean, that's a really important information war. I mean, you're literally injecting something into your body. This is not just a talking point.
Oh, yeah. It's had global consequences for a long, long time. And it started really back with the smallpox vaccine. And that's over 200 years ago, 225 years ago. And that spread across the globe as a thing. And we're still stuck with it. So they didn't figure out that it wasn't the best idea.
Have you noticed, though, that it almost has a kind of cult following? When you talk about vaccines, the mood changes almost instantly.
Well, I've never noticed that. I've noticed it a lot. So I bring it up to various people and they're just like, they look at you like you're a crazy person. And even if you show data, charts, and that type of stuff, a lot of people will look at that and just be, I don't know what to say. They don't know what to say. They don't know what to do about it. And they just kind of just ignore it and move on to another topic. It's an overwhelming thing. And that happened to me when I first started. Mm. When I started looking at the data and creating my own charts and verifying what I had found in a book, I thought, oh, that guy's crazy. That can't be true. And so I kept on going and going and going until I ended up in the U.S. Vital Statistics, got the real data and created my first chart. And I was like, oh, wow, how could this be? How could I be wrong? I must be wrong. Something is not right. It can't be. This can't be true. This chart can't be true. But eventually I settled into it. So right from the beginning, I thought this can't be true. This data can't be true, but it was true. And I've had, over 25 years to settle into it. So I'm 100% sure the data is correct. And when you accept the data, that's most of the argument. You know, so once you look at this, like, why are we doing this?
I've told you before, but your work, well, you and your co-author Susan Humphries had such a profound effect on me that that you're probably the leading cause of my kid being unvaccinated.
Well, that's great. I think it's great. Other people think it's horrible, but it makes sense to me. I mean, I think we've gone down the wrong path for 300 years. It's not what we should be doing now.
But I mean, Roman, if you just think about it for like 10 seconds, right, you go, okay, for the entirety of human history, right, babies were born, and according to the narrative, they were just dying en masse until 300 mm-hmm. years ago or 250 years ago, whatever, until they started getting an injection right in their arm.
This didn't fix the problem.
Well, they were dying en masse only, as you've shown, after the Industrial Revolution. I mean, childbirth itself is not a dangerous thing per se.
No, but children were dying of things like diarrhea, and they were dying of diseases because they were living in filth and their horrible conditions, and they had bizarre medical notions. All these things combined, if you were to put people today into those conditions, they would be dying in mass too. But we had a what I call the world's greatest health revolution starting around 1875. Things changed. People got healthier. They abandoned a lot of these bizarre medical notions like bleeding and mercury and these types of things. And people started living longer, healthier lives, which is not surprising. So the nutrition improved, the pollution dropped, and living conditions were far better. And as soon as that happened, all these, you know, these diseases basically just vanished. So by the time you got to the 1950s, 60s, they weren't part of the mortality statistics. They were a very small part, like measles and scarlet fever and whooping cough. You know, people weren't dying of those things. It was very rare. And it was getting more and more rare year by year.
So what you're telling me is that mortality was reduced thanks to plumbers.
Plumbers and a lot of people were involved, millions of people that, you know, protested living conditions because they were living in this horrible tenements. You went to the bathroom, it went into the streets, and then that went into your drinking supply, and that's what you drank. The air pollution was horrible. Water pollution was horrible. Working conditions, people lived, you know, worked 12 to 16 hours a day. Children as young as four were living and working in those conditions, and they were working in mines and factories. And it's amazing people even lived. And a lot of people didn't. They, you know, they made it to 20 or 30 if you were lucky, and then died basically of just being worn out. It was a very horrible time for the, you know, the poor people. Poor, the rich were still okay. So if you went to like 1880, the West End of London, that's where the rich people lived, and they had the carriages and the ball gowns and all that. The East End of London was horribly poor and only a few miles away. And those people lived in basically in a living, you know, giant sewer, and they were not doing well, and they struggled to even stay alive.
As I said, your book, Dissolving Illusions, had a significant impact on me. It was a few years ago. In fact, I think I've told you the story, but I'll just tell it again. I was on a hunting trip, boys' weekend, and I was sharing a room with a friend of mine, and we were chatting about vaccines. And he said to me, "Listen, I've got this book. Don't jump to conclusions, but just have a look through it." And he hands me this book, Dissolving Illusions, and that just changed the course of history for me.
Great, that's awesome. And you know, I don't make an argument just to make an argument to make myself feel good, or just because I believe it. I present the data, and I have a presentation. We can just go through the charts.
Yes,
the charts are, you know, tell most of the story, and the quotes from medical journals and history books tell the story too. And so when you look at all that, it's like, wow. You know, I think that alone convinces you that there's something, at least something wrong with this whole vaccine narrative and this whole disease narrative, you know, that we should be afraid of microbes all across the board. And again, 1950s, 1960s, most people didn't really care anymore. There just wasn't a big problem. There were much bigger problems than that. And but they've turned this into a giant industry, I think.
Well, your book has made it. Your co-author, Suzanne, was on Joe Rogan's show.
Yeah. Well, you know, when we first published in 2013, I was like, I'm done with vaccines. I don't want to talk about this anymore. I've been working on it for, you know, 15 years by that point, or 20 years. I was like, I was burnt out, and I didn't think we'd sell that many books, honestly. I thought it'd be a couple hundred books, but it's taken off. I think the reason is because it presents all the data, presents all the references, so you can go check all this stuff. So it's a very factual book, and we try to be fairly emotionally neutral. And but the data speaks for itself. It's amazing that it never was real. Well, there are doctors and scientists that reveal this kind of information periodically through history, but it never caught on, and they would publish in medical journals, but they were basically ignored by the mainstream. So I didn't think we were going to, you know, do that much with it. I just felt like I needed to publish this stuff because I had this information, and then out it went, and it's taken a life of its own. And some people don't like that, but
do you know if RFK has seen your book?
Mm-hmm. Yep. That I've been told he has. And unfortunately, we still haven't seen the charts up on any official government website. It doesn't have to be my charts. It's their data. It's the CDC data, or it's the NHS, National Health Services data.
Right? Yeah, you just let it look there. Pretty.
Yeah, I just put it into a chart format. But the, so far, it's been... It hasn't happened. I don't know if it's being resisted to happen or what. But I think people should get that information just as a point of information so you can make an informed decision. But it just hasn't happened. And I've been pushing for it, but it just doesn't gain any traction.
Okay, well, I know you got some slides to show me.
Okay, so there's some contact information, dissolvingillusions.com. I'm on, well, currently on Substack, currently on Twitter. And I have a new book called TenderMercies.com. You can go there. After talking to a few people that didn't want to read Dissolving Illusions because it's, you know, it's very nutrient dense. It's lots of references. And I've had people start it and they say, oh, I can't get through it. It's too difficult. So I decided to write a historical fiction book, which makes it more entertaining, introduces all sorts of medical notions of the time and how life was in London and what I think is the world's greatest health freedom movement that actually worked in Leicester, England. So that's all in the book, but it's presented in a, you know, more of a human, you know, drama kind of format. So I think it's been being well received. People really like it. Okay, so this is basically the first charts I created. It's a, you know, CDC data. And here you can see these diseases were higher in the beginning of the century. And by the time we came out with penicillin and streptomycin and the whooping cough vaccine, the measles vaccine, it was trending towards zero. And there was no scarlet fever vaccine. So just from this chart alone, you can see that the vast majority of the problem was solved without any real medical interventions. And then I was able to get data from England starting, they started much earlier gathering statistics, 1838. And it's even more dramatic here. So during the 1800s, during the Industrial Revolution, people were dying from scarlet fever all the time. Measles, whooping cough, all these types of things. And you can see in the chart tells you the story. Penicillin came out in 1944, streptomycin 1947, DTP vaccine and measles vaccine basically were down by almost 100% in mortality rate, which is tremendous. And this should be celebrated as, wow, what a great, great thing we did. We got rid of all these diseases, but it's basically just ignored. It's never been really talked about, not very much. Here's some data from Massachusetts, and you can see the big killer, tuberculosis. That was a real big killer, much bigger. You can see measles at the bottom of there, that little green line. This is a phenomenal killer. And again, by the time they came out with antibiotics and the BCG vaccine, we're already down by 98%. It was trending down towards zero. And if anybody wants to, they can go to this link and actually get that real data and recreate this chart. It's not that difficult to do. So you can actually verify that this chart is real. And as a matter of fact, you can see in the little blue box, that's the references to create this chart. You can go find these references and redo these charts any which way you want. And the CDC in their vital statistics.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to get stronger just around the corner. So you can give everything you've got. Whether you want to crush a few reps before class with our expanded strength equipment or sweat it out on your way home from work. With over 2,800 locations, there's a Planet Fitness close to you. And most are open 24 hours. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends January 30th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
Back in the 60s, had charts. And you can go over, look at those charts in this PDF on page 85. that's the chart they put into their CDC document. And here is the same chart I would create, you know, decades later. So it's, the data is correct. The data matches. No one's ever argued about the data. And then there's been various, I made it look pretty because I had technology. And then there's been books that's talked about these types of things. Deaths from whooping cough, 97% occurred between 1901 and 1945. And this is from a particular book. And they showed this particular chart in a bar format. But it basically shows the same thing. Whooping cough was basically tackled well before there was a vaccine. The various quotes that you can find in the medical literature, and this is talking about measles from 1959. So here they're talking about over the, you know, a decade, they saw almost no complications of any age, of any children. Everybody made full recoveries from measles. It was basically just something you got. It was mild. It was not a big deal. Here's another article, and this guy is questioning whether you really need a whooping cough vaccine because it was a mild disease by that point and very small mortality. And this is by 1960. Again, The Lancet, no evidence that vaccination played a major role in the decline in incidence and mortality. So he was arguing again against, you know, this mass vaccination idea. And this is another good one. Whooping cough, measles are no longer important causes of death or severe illness, except in a small minority of infants who are usually otherwise disadvantaged. So most children escaped without, you know, who were not vaccinated. It's not a big deal. It wasn't a big, huge issue. And this is a very good study to go read. Again, the study, you can go find the study at the bottom of the slide. It tells you what the name of the study is. You can go find it and you can read the study yourself. So most cases of whooping cough are mild. When I was starting this, I always thought you basically coughed and coughed and coughed to death. But a lot of times you can't even tell somebody has whooping cough, you know, the particular bacteria that's supposed to be involved in that. And so parents can be reassured the serious outcome is unlikely. So they often try to scare you that your child's going to cough to death. But most of the time it was just mild, like a mild cough. Pediatrics talked about the 90% of decline of infectious diseases and mortality among children before 1940, before vaccines or antibiotics. This guy in 1951 talked about the, you know, all these diseases are declining, and it had nothing to do with antibiotics and all these things. And he basically concluded there's some other overall factor that was causing the decline in all these diseases because it wasn't the vaccines or antibiotics or other medical interventions. And then there was a study published in 1977. And they looked at, you know, how much medical interventions actually improve things. But they said at most 3.5% of the total decline in mortality since 1900 were, you know, basically tied to medical notions like antibiotics and vaccines. And there they showed a chart and they showed the decreasing in mortality. And this showed the gross national product, how much percent of the medical care went to GDP. And what's interesting is if you look at this, you see in 1930, it was like 5% of our, or 3.5% of GDP. And then by 1970, it was 8.5%. Today, it's approaching 20%. We're spending so much on so-called healthcare, which is really medical care. And we're doing far worse now. We have obesity rates, you know, off the scale. People are deficient in vitamin D. All sorts of things are going really negative, despite us spending more and more and more on healthcare. This is an interesting chart where you show the pertussis or whooping cough vaccine came in 1957. You can see the total deaths had dropped to close to zero. In the 70s, there was a scare in neurological damage from the DTP vaccine. So vaccination rates dropped. That's that dotted blue line. But you'll notice that when it dropped to 30%, there was no increase in deaths. There's no big spike up in deaths. That didn't happen. So they eventually got the vaccination rates back up to 90%, but there's, you know, it didn't affect the death rate at all. In Sweden, they determined that the DTP vaccine was ineffective and it was concerns over safety. So they suspended national vaccination for DTP. And in this chart, you can see for 17 years, they had no vaccination, national vaccination program, but there's no increase in deaths. And even by 1953, when they started using the DTP vaccine, deaths were, you know, near zero. And if we zoom in a little bit, we can see that there's no change. There's no more deaths from whooping cough than when there was no vaccine being used. And then there's interesting, you know, I don't want to get too deep into this, but the DTP vaccine was causing neurological damage. And they argued for decades over how often that happens and whether it's true, which is not true. And they went back and forth, but they eventually came out with what they called attenuated pertussis. So it's a more mild kind of vaccine. So most of the time in the Western world, they use the DTaP vaccine. But the problem with the DTaP vaccine is because it has less surface antigens, it doesn't have the same effect as the DTP vaccine. And so what this guy, Dr. James Cherry, who is the world's leading expert in pertussis and pertussis immunization, noted, because of this linked epitone suppression, which is what they used to call original antigenic sin, which means when you got when you get the shot, it programs your immune system in a particular way, and you can't change that. So that's what they call linked epitome suppression. He says all children who are primed by DTaP vaccines will be more susceptible to pertussis, whooping cough, throughout their lifetimes, and there's no easy way to decrease this increased lifetime susceptibility. So he suggests administering DTaP, or Tdap vaccine, every 3 years to all adolescents for adults who are primed by the DTaP vaccine. So amazingly, he's suggesting that you should get this vaccine every 3 years for the rest of your life. Not that this was a total disaster and a failure. It's just like, oh, we'll just give you a vaccine every 3 years. Like, it's no big deal. This should have just blown the wheels off the bus, saying, oh, wow, you guys totally screwed up. Now we have to get a vaccine every 3 years because you made us program in a particular direction. We can also look at the flu pneumonia. They're lumped together. You see that brown line. And the big spike that goes off is the 1918 flu pandemic. So it started at deaths 200 per 100,000 and dropped down into the 30s. And you can see most of the 90% of the decrease happened before they started vaccinating. The dotted blue line is the vaccination coverage rate. So they slowly got it up by the 2000s or so, up to 60-70%. And this is in the 65-year or older. And you see the brown line out there basically stays flatline. Nothing really changes as the vaccination rates increase. And if we zoom in on that, we can see that the vaccination rates increase to 60-70%, and the brown line kind of goes up. So the mortality rate increases for a while and then decreases. But over that 40 years, there's really no change in mortality rate. So the vaccine hasn't accomplished anything in mortality rate. And you see that dotted blue line that's basically flatlined. That's the trend line. So there's no real change. And very interestingly, in a paper in Cell, Host, and Microbe, these three authors, and Fauci's the third author on this paper. And I just want to read this part. After more than 60 years of experience in influenza vaccines, very little improvement in vaccine prevention of infection has been noted. That's like, wow. As pointed out decades ago and still true today, the rates of effectiveness of our best approved influenza vaccines would be inadequate for licensure. It is not surprising that none of the predominantly mucosal respiratory viruses has ever been effectively controlled by vaccines. Vaccines against non-systemic mucosal respiratory virus with high mortality rates have thus far eluded vaccine efforts. So after 60 years of failure, they're going to keep on going because they have new ideas, new RNA technology. But here they're admitting the vaccine hasn't worked, but they still tell you get the flu shot every year. I have a new chart here that you probably haven't seen before because I haven't published it anywhere. So this is a smallpox. So you can see smallpox is the red line going up and down, up and down. And we had various vaccination acts put in England. So in 1853, they had very strict compulsory laws. They made them even tougher in 1867. And you can see up and down, smallpox is still killing people. But in 1885, which was the same year of the Great Leicester Revolution to stop vaccination, it suddenly drops. And it drops for 10 years, at least, according to the data. So it used to be about 30 per 100,000, and it dropped to into one or two. And what happened there is they took smallpox cases and isolated them. They took them out of London and put them on a barge, basically a hospital barge. And so the deaths just dropped. So what's important to note here is during that whole time of strict vaccination in London, they still had deaths from smallpox. They didn't solve the problem. That's a half century, up and down, people still dying about the same rate. And if you look at the trend line, it's essentially the same. I mean, it's pretty flatlined. So nothing has really changed, including that massive spike up in around 1872, where they had a huge epidemic of smallpox. So when we look at this data, the data shows that the vaccine didn't fix anything. Things stayed the same. What fixed it was isolating cases. And they talk about this. This data is from a royal commission. So it was printed in 1896. And they concluded in 1885, the Metropolitan Asylum Boards began to convey smallpox patients by steamer to a floating hospital on the Thames, right? The comparative immunity of London has been enjoyed the recent years is no doubt due to this policy, which has been so vigilantly carried out. But we forgot about this piece of history. Instead, people claim it was the smallpox vaccine that saved us, right? And the data shows that's just simply not true. We can also look at other places, and this is Leicester, England. Around 1885, vaccinations really dropped off because the population had overthrown their local government and said, no, we're not being vaccinated anymore. You can choose to do it, but couldn't be compulsory anymore. And you can see their vaccination rates, the blue line, dropped off and trended towards zero, 10%, zero. And then you would expect, and this is what the medical officials of the time expected, was there was going to be massive increases in deaths from smallpox in Leicester. But instead, the opposite was true. The deaths remained near zero, even when vaccination rates were very, very low. That ideology of not vaccinating or not being forced to be vaccinated spread through all of England. And you can see the dotted blue line. Vaccination rates dropped and dropped and dropped, still 40% in 1920s. But there was no resurgence of smallpox. And this is what was talked about in the medical literature. Well, sooner or later, we're all going to pay horribly because we're not taking this vaccine. But that never happened. In this chart, you can see in Leicester, the many lines going up and down, those are the various age groups. And during the time of vaccination, during those half century, you can see the lines went up and down and the mortality rate for children didn't really change. It was all basically the same. It was pretty flatlined. It was only when vaccination rates dropped and they started basically the health revolution, cleaning up sewers, getting children out of mines and factories, do all that cleanup so that people lived a better life. And you can see that the mortality rate for children continued to decline and decline. So by 1910, it was on its way trending towards zero. A smart doctor, Millard, in 1914 wrote a book, The Vaccination Question, The Light of Modern Experience. And here he noticed the same thing. The vaccination rate curve was dropping, but so too was enteric fever, scarlet fever, and smallpox. They all declined at the same time. So he concluded there's got to be other factors that are involved. It wasn't the vaccine that was doing all this stuff. And then the vaccine was decreasing, so therefore it couldn't have been the vaccine. Unfortunately, his book, like many other things, were ignored. And by the 1940, in this article from Public Health Reports, you could see that the number of deaths, the case fatality rate, all just declined for smallpox at the same time as vaccination rates were dropping. So, you know, when you take all this data together, all these different diseases put together, and all the data shows that it wasn't vaccines or antibiotics that, you know, saved us from everything.
It would appear to me that what has saved us is environment and what we eat and stress and or lack of stress, etc.
Yeah. Right. All of those put together. I mean, people were living a better life by the 1930s, 40s, and 50s. Their lives were so much better than it was. And there were people alive then that realized how things were horrible then, and they were very happy and grateful. But we forgot that history. So you can imagine living in the East End of London, where you lived maybe 10, 12 people to a room with no ventilation. You went to the bathroom in a, you know, basically a privy all together. That stuff went into the streets. That washed into your water supply. Your food was rotting because there was no refrigeration. So you had to eat whatever you can get your hands on, stale old bread and rotten meat. And you had to work just to survive, you know, 12 hours, 16 hours a day. And you had to send your kids to these factories to make a few extra pennies. The pollution was horrible. The London fog wasn't a fog per se. It was industrial pollution. So you had all these different factors together. And then when you got sick, people would do things like bleed you, or they had something called a hot regimen. They would put you into a room, make it very hot, cover you with blankets, don't give you any water. The idea was you're going to sweat the disease out. That caused a lot of deaths. So you had these ridiculous medical notions. And vaccination, what we think of vaccination now is like there's a nice needle, they put some alcohol in there and they inject you with something. But that's not what a vaccine really was back then. They would take this sharp instrument called a lancet. They would cut your arm repeatedly and put this material from that they got from somebody else's arm. And arm-to-arm vaccination was done for essentially 100 years until they finally made it illegal in 1898. So what they would be doing is spreading pus from one person's arm to another person's arm to another person's arm. And you can imagine putting some pus into your bloodstream might end badly. But this is what a vaccine was. So that also died down. Vaccination died down. So that was another factor why people got healthier.
It's still bonkers to me, though, that so many people think that an injection in your arm can give you improved health for years to come.
Yeah, well, that's the kind of the notion, right? And that started, like I said, 300 years ago. So this is Thomas Sydenham. He was the father of English medicine. He noticed some of the things we were talking about here. So if no mischief be done, either by physician or nurse, smallpox is the most slight and safe of all diseases. I'm like, wow, you know, that seemed kind of crazy. The thing is, they were treating smallpox in a particular way. They were putting you in a hot room and giving you no water. So, of course, people died en masse. And he decided, well, that's a bad idea. We're going to use the cold regimen, which is the opposite of that. And then he didn't have any problems with these kind of cases. He actually talked to this Dr. Cole, and they had letters back and forth. And Dr. Cole, showed the same thing. And he was thanking Dr. Sydenham for solving the mystery of smallpox. That's, we don't have to worry about smallpox anymore. And this is back in the late 1600s. I'm skipping a whole bunch of history because it's quite long, but Edward Jenner came along and replaced this idea of inoculation. Inoculation was originally started in the 1720s, and that was taking something from somebody who had smallpox and scratching it onto your arm to give you smallpox so then you wouldn't have to worry about smallpox later. That was the idea. But that didn't really work out too well, so people were still dying from smallpox. So Edward Jenner came along and came up with this idea. I'm going to take some stuff from an animal, a cow, or he thought actually it was a horse, And we're going to put that onto your arm. And then we'll take the lesions from your arm, which he said was, you know, what he called cowpoxing, and spread it to the other people. So it's basically the same methodology. It was just started off with an animal. But through those various decades, no one could decide what a, you know, what a vaccine really was, because they thought it came from a cow or maybe a horse or even a goat or even a buffalo. So they would take these different mixtures and put it on people's arms and then determine whether they thought it worked. And then they would spread it from that person's arm to another person's arm, another person's arm. So that's how a vaccine really worked. Idea behind the term vaccine, because it used to be called cowpoxing, and vaca is the word for cow. So it had to do with this cowpox notion. Later on, it morphed into, you know, protecting you from other diseases, but that's what the original notion was. 1814, this guy, John Birch, noted that the idea of putting people in hot chambers and giving them these cordials and things like that, he determined was two-thirds of the reason people died from smallpox. It wasn't they were just getting a microbe and then dying. It was these conditions, the bad conditions they were in, these mistakes in medical notions. And here is what a lancet was. There was different lancets, different sharp instruments that they would actually, you know, bring you into a room, cut you repeatedly, and then put this stuff into your arm. And so that picture on the left is what your arm would end up looking like. That was considered a success. And as a matter of fact, when that died down, if it didn't go badly, you would get these marks, which they would call scarification. So they knew that was your original vaccine card. They could look at your arm and see that you were vaccinated at some point, because those scars would stay for life. But if it went badly, that's the picture on the right, then you could have this massive sore, you could lose your arm, you could die, as you might expect if you put pus into your bloodstream. And again, this is the accepted medical idea of the time, that this was a great idea, this was a great invention. So this diagram kind of gives you an idea of what a smallpox vaccine was. It could come from a horse, a cow, a buffalo, a pig, all these different animal sources that they would basically take and then scratch onto your arm. There was a faction, and the yellow circles are the main factions, or it was from a horse, a cow. It could also come from somebody who died from smallpox or was exposed to, you know, there was a blanket that they slept with, and they would hang that on the cow's head to get the cow to have the same illness. And then they would take that and scratch it onto your arm. So it either came from a horse, a cow, or a corpse. And then that, from there, it would go from person to person, as it shows on the right. And that's arm-to-arm vaccination that went on for 100 years. And then they said they had something called retrovaccination, where they would take the pus from the animal, put it onto the human, and after a while, when it didn't seem like it was very strong, they would put it back on the animal and then back to humans and back to animals. And as you might imagine, there was blood and bacteria and fungus and yeasts and all sorts of stuff in that concoction, which they found by the later 1800s, as they looked under the microscope, they would look at this vaccine material as filled with microbes. So the original idea of these vaccinators is that they thought it was filled with just vaccine virus, and that's all that was in that material. But it turned out that wasn't true at all. So this is kind of what a real vaccine was. And here's an example. This doctor got a letter back from this vaccine company, and they had to admit that the vaccine wasn't from a cow. It was from some tramp having smallpox who slept in the stable. That's how they got this vaccine material to get started. So again, you had three different things. It was from a cow, it was from a horse, and it was from a corpse who died from smallpox. And they would scratch that onto a cow and then go from person to person to person. And sometimes it would end in disaster. There's not too many pictures from that time, but this is a poor, unfortunate Miss Fanny Lent, who got vaccinated, turned into basically a skeleton and died a horrible death. these types of things were often just ignored because who wants to talk about that? They want to talk about the successful medical intervention. Again, you know, if we look at the data, this is in Leicester, the vaccine, because the people protested and won in 1885, the vaccination rates dropped, but there's no increase in smallpox deaths. And if you notice that big spike up there in 1872, they talked about that in The Lancet. How many people died despite being vaccinated? So the hospitals were overwhelmed. And this is the genesis of the main anti-vaccination movement, because people experienced that the vaccine didn't work in 1871 to 73. They also experienced that they could get severely injured by the vaccine, and they knew people who died from the vaccine. And so by 1880, slowly over those few years, by 1885, they said, no, we're not doing it. They organized a protest of between 20,000 and 100,000 people in Leicester. They marched. And they, the following year, they voted out all the pro-vaccine people in their government, and they installed a new government that said, no, you don't have to get vaccinated. The vaccination rates dropped. But there was no resurgence of smallpox. It actually stayed very low. And then Leicester did better than all the surrounding towns that still had vaccination. And here is some documentation that the vaccination rates kept on declining, 50% by 1914, 18% by 1948. So there's this notion that people had this vaccine going for a long time, and that's how smallpox was banished from the planet, which isn't true. But another interesting thing is smallpox became a very mild disease. Here's a picture of a gentleman. That was smallpox. If you go on the internet or you go into these medical books, they always show the worst case of smallpox. They're like totally filled with pustules. But by the early 1900s, this was smallpox was like. It was very mild. There's another case of mild smallpox. So by that time, they're talking about how mild smallpox was. It was hard to tell between smallpox and chickenpox. And again, the smallpox, because it became mild, you had a fatality rate that was decreased by, you know, almost 99%. And again, the journal articles here are at the bottom of the slide. So you can go look up this journal article and then see that this quote is accurate. You can read the whole article. Now, Dr. Millard, who followed this for his entire career, you know, also wrote about this in the British Medical Journal. Vaccination has been steadily declining ever since the Conscience Clause, which was in 1898, where you didn't have to get vaccinated. You could just say, well, it's against my principles, fill out a little form, and most of the time you were allowed not to get the vaccine. Right? So as soon as that was introduced, 2/3 of children born are not vaccinated, yet smallpox mortality has also declined until quite negligible. Pretty much nobody was dying from smallpox, despite no vaccination. And Thomas Mack noted that, and he was one of the boots on the ground. He was an expert in this area. He said, it's not because of our mass herd immunity. It disappeared because of our economic development. It's not from universal vaccination. And he also noted, disappearance of smallpox was facilitated, not impeded, by economic development, which is what we were talking about, long before the World Health Organization smallpox eradication program. So all these countries, smallpox basically disappeared and became not of any significance, not from universally vaccinating them. That's the story of smallpox and vaccination. It's a crazy story. It was never really a good idea, and it's morphed into other vaccines, other notions of protecting you from the outside world, when the real solution is having a healthy society and healthy people.
But that's the entire story of vaccines, actually.
Yeah, but basically, I mean, there's always more and more detail, but, you know, the data shows that The history books show it. And it's really kind of bizarre, actually. It should have been kind of laughed at by the early 1900s. Like, wow, you know, this is really ridiculous. Charles Creighton talked about it. He was a brilliant man. Unfortunately, he wrote books against vaccination, and his fellow doctors were not too appreciative of that. He actually wrote in the Encyclopedia Britannica in the 1880s a very critical article about vaccination, which stayed there until the 1920s when it got removed and was replaced with vaccine therapies. Vaccine therapies are going to help us and save us from many things. So they deleted his work and replaced it with the idea that we're going to vaccinate for everything. And you can go look that up in these old encyclopedias.
Roman, do you know of any vaccine historically that has had a positive net benefit?
I don't think so. I mean, the big killers were tuberculosis. That was the biggest killer. We don't vaccinate for tuberculosis in the United States. I know they do in other countries, but we don't have big outbreaks of tuberculosis everywhere. You know, we don't vaccinate for that. Scarlet fever was one of the bigger killers. We don't vaccinate for scarlet fever. Nobody worries about scarlet fever, even though that was a much bigger killer than smallpox or whooping cough or measles. Whooping cough and measles, the mortality rate had declined by almost 100% by the time they came out with vaccines for it. And we saw in the charts that when whooping cough was interrupted, because the people were rightly worried about neurological damage from the DTP vaccine, there was no big resurgence of anything. The smallpox vaccine, as we've seen, didn't solve the problem in London or Leicester. It was only when the vaccine started being used less that things got better. And the health revolution is what really took care of the problem. So yeah, where's the evidence that shows that these are great ideas? Now we have like tons of other vaccines, but it's interesting because all these other diseases weren't any part of, you know, a part of any mortality statistics. So if you look at those old mortality statistics, they weren't dying from chickenpox or RSV or whatever new things they have they're trying to protect you from. There's, you know, so why are we doing all that stuff to prevent illness, supposedly? But they weren't a big deal back in the 1800s and 1900s, RSV. You know, so but why are we doing that now? So maybe they have some kind of benefit, but I don't know. It's certainly not improving a lot of mortality.
And that's why they have to keep banging the same drum, telling you that vaccines are safe and effective.
Yeah, that started with Edward Jenner. He said that in 1802. He said, yeah, this is my invention, because he wanted to be famous, and yeah, he became famous. My invention of cowpoxing is very gentle, very safe, and will banish smallpox from the planet. And so he was saying it's safe and effective, right? And that idea has stuck. It's just an automatic knee-jerk reaction to any vaccine. It's automatically safe and effective. It doesn't matter who makes it, what's in it, how it's administered. It's automatically safe and effective. That's just been programmed into human beings to think that. But again, you know, were these really necessary? And they certainly weren't safe, as we saw with Miss Lent there. And lots and lots of other people were killed from these ideas of scratching stuff onto your arm. But those were just not something they wanted to talk about. We just want to talk about how great it is and how it saved us. So I don't see any real evidence that any of these vaccines have improved lifespan and saved lives. Certainly not from the historical data.
But what makes vaccines a brilliant product for pharmaceutical companies is that it's pretty much impossible to kind of falsify. So they go, well, you got sick 7 years at 7 years old because you didn't get vaccinated when you were 6 months old. Now, how do you even begin to to argue this?
Well, as we saw with Dr. Cherry, he says, you know, the vaccine wears off after three years. So people did notice, like, for example, the whooping cough vaccine that, well, maybe you didn't get it when you were a kid, but then you would get it as an adolescent. So it shifted. Things shifted around. So then they have to say, well, now you have to have another booster. So they can always like say, well, it kind of worked, but we just have to add boosters. And they did that with the smallpox vaccine. So Jenner's original idea was to protect you for life, and it was easy and safe. Well, that turned out after a couple of decades, well, people are still getting smallpox, so what are we going to do? The idea of revaccination was born. So we're going to revaccinate you. And that started out, well, maybe we have to do it every 10 years. Some people thought every 3 years. Some people thought every year. Some people thought you just keep vaccinating until you don't get a reaction on your arm. So this idea, you know, it's like, oh, we're going to protect you with a single shot, never works. They always have to add more and more and more, trying to compensate for what they did.
Whenever a doctor talks about getting a vaccine, they never include anything to do with sunshine, diet, health, nothing. Just get this vaccine.
Well, I think that's in general for our entire medical system. We've confused healthcare with medical care. And healthcare is really in your ballpark. It's your responsibility. You know, get plenty of rest, drink clean fluids, eat whole foods, you know, exercise, have a good relationship with your family and friends. Don't be afraid. Don't be terrified, because fear itself is a disease promoter.
Yeah.
So do all the things for you and your family and your local community, then you don't have much of a problem. If you're going to Dunkin' Donuts and not exercising and watching media and being scared and having no social interactions because, well, we have Facebook, of course, that's social interaction, and all this other garbage, then you end up being sickly. And then sickly means you have heart disease and diabetes and cancer and all these other issues that you probably wouldn't have had if you were, you know, living a healthy lifestyle. So then you have to go get health care, which is really medical care, to try to patch things up to compensate for bad lifestyle decisions and choices and things you were thrust into. I know plenty of people are trapped into, well, I'm too busy, so I have to have a cup of coffee, and I don't have time to eat right, and I don't have time to go to the gym, and I'm really stressed, and I have to watch, you know, fear porn nonstop on, you know, whatever, YouTube or whatever, and I don't have time for friends, and they end up in a disaster. And then you go to the doctor, like, well, your cholesterol is a little high, here's some this and that and the other thing, and, you know, have you got your flu shot? You better get that before you get sick and die. And, you know, but I think all of it is just a broken system. And I think if we went back to the 1950s, where we only used about 3.5% of our GDP on so-called medical, you know, healthcare, medical care, we would be much better off. Hospitals could be there for, you know, accidents, which it does great at, or other things like that, but not continuously like trying to fix lifestyle problems.
Do you ever feel like you just, you know, shouting into the void?
Yes. that's, yeah, so I've talked about this for way too long. It's like, okay, we're going to talk about this again. It's like, you know, it's second nature to me, but a lot of people haven't seen this information. So it's getting out there. I saw Aaron Seary doing a similar chart about measles and declined mortality rate at 98% in some kind of video. So it's getting out there, and more people realize that. And a lot of people have shifted their ideas about it. And, you know, recently they decreased the vaccine schedule here. I think a lot of that is because people are like tired of having so many vaccines. So if we reduce it, they'll still vaccinate for the, you know, key diseases like measles. So I think it's a little bit of a little bit of marketing, make sure everybody still stays with the main vaccines. But anyway, people are learning more and more. So I'm hoping that it, you know, takes root and people also not just like, oh, just don't get the vaccine, but, you know, get healthier, right? So eat whole foods, exercise, all these types of things, get rest. And, you know, don't listen to these people that are trying to scare you all the time about every damn topic on the planet. So I think if we do that, then we have a healthy society, not a sick society. That's where we need to go and get away from these top-down government tells you you got to do all these things.
Yeah, stop doom scrolling.
Doom scrolling, yeah, no kidding. That's very scary stuff. And that's why I wrote this Tender Mercies book, because people don't want to read, you know, nutrient-dense, lots of references. You can be entertained and kind of learn a little bit more about history. And I think it's very inspiring because, you know, they end up in Leicester. They're fighting the good fight against the vaccine laws of the time, compulsory laws. And, you know, history shows they win. Oh, if anybody wants any of these slides and want any of this info, just send me an email. I'll send it to you.
Well, I was just about to say, how can my audience get in contact with you and follow your work?
Yeah. Oh, so dissolvingillusions.com. is probably the best way to get to me, or tendermerciesbook.com. And then you can find me on Twitter, or they call it X now, whatever, or Substack. It's not that hard. I also have a Telegram channel. So you can just find me there instead of trying to read that.
Okay, Roman Bistranek, thank you for joining me in the trenches.